KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Maria Hinojosa. She's Mexican-American and immigrant, a Latina journalist who came to her work as a way of telling stories about people like her, stories she says she didn't see growing up. She joined us recently to discuss what she's learned over the years about the nature of racism and how you go about having difficult conversations with people who are feeling anxious and afraid about the demographic changes in the country. Join us after this.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Maria Hinojosa's story is so American. She was born in Mexico, brought to the United States by her parents when she was a toddler. The family ended up in the south side of Chicago, and they settled in. Although she says her father questioned himself every day about whether he had made the right decision in bringing his family to the U.S. He felt this kind of split identity, and Maria felt it too. In her book, she said she had a Latina part to her heart and emotion and a gringa part, order and control. And it's this mixture that's American. Maria has described herself as a blend of Azteca New Yorker, salsa-dancing, goddess-worshipping, hard-hitting journalist. The journalism part came after she realized that even though her family had consumed plenty of news when she was growing up, papers and TV programs and magazines, they never really saw stories about themselves, Latinos, immigrants. And I think that's why she became a journalist, to tell those kinds of stories. She was the first Latina reporter at NPR, the first Latina correspondent hired by CNN, by PBS. But it wasn't really until 2010, when she founded her own media organization called Futuro Media Group, that she was able to really cover the range of diverse voices she always had in mind. Maria is also anchor and executive producer of the popular public radio program Latino USA. She joined us last week in the moot courtroom of the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. This was the last in our series of conversations about diversity. And when we began our conversation, Maria spotted the quote on the wall from the Reverend Martin Luther King.
My God, I'm just realizing where I am, and I just turned around, and then I was like, oh my God, it's my hero, Martin Luther King Jr., on the wall here. The quote is, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. So it's just, I'm kind of like, Dr. King, thank you for making your presence known to me right now. It's interesting to me because Martin Luther King was the person who made me feel like maybe I could be an American. I was lucky enough to be alive when he was around. And I remember seeing him and just thinking like, okay. Because the other person who was very much in the news at the time was George Wallace, who was running for president. And so he was giving the opposite message. The message I was getting from him is that you are not a part of this country and we want you out of this country. So to hear Martin Luther King, I just understood that he was talking about me even though I wasn't black. So for me, I've been highly aware of race from the time I had a sense of being, right? And frankly, the first time I was aware of race or ethnicity was that moment when my Jewish best friend and I, we were walking home from school on the south side of Chicago, and we were making plans as to which basement we were going to hide in. Because we figured if George Wallace won, Jewish family, Mexican family, we would have to figure out how to hide together.
Wow.
So we were making calculations like, well, which one is better, hers, because there was an elevator, but which ones was bigger, ours, because there were only steps down. So some of us have been talking about race for the longest time. For the longest time. But as you said in the beginning, we haven't seen those conversations reflected around us. So therefore, talking about race seems really difficult and complicated. And I guess part of what I've been doing with my life and my career is saying, yeah, let's just talk about this. What is there to fear? There's qué miedo. And by the way, talking about race in Mexico is also complicated. So that was coming up because, you know, when I left Chicago to go move to New York to go to school in 1979, mi abuelita, who was in Mexico City and who had come many times to visit us in the States, writes me this handwritten letter with her beautiful cursive. It was like a 10-page letter in those por avión envelopes that would come from Mexico City, you know, and arrived to my dorm in New York City. And she wrote, please be, in Spanish, please be very careful about going to the Bronx because there are many black people there. And I was like, abuelita, I grew up on the south side of Chicago. Black people were around everywhere. What are you talking about? You've never been to New York or the Bronx. What? And then I realized that these were all racial constructions that she was interpreting because she was watching Hollywood movies and television. So that's how America's been talking about race in many ways.
How do you think about the nature of racism? Biological, cultural, a little bit of both. I mean, as you have come to understand it now, where does it come from? Is it just tribal? Is it baked into us? What do you think?
No, I don't think it's I don't think it's baked into us. I really don't. I mean, I want to hope and believe that. I mean, look, I'm not Pollyanna-ish. People are different and not everybody's going to love each other. But this issue of race, to me, does feel like, and increasingly now in the United States of America, I feel so much like it is something that is being taught, purposefully taught. There was a headline that came up, I don't know on what digital platform that it came up, but it said, you know, why white supremacists insist on drinking milk and other ways that they are, you know, making up science to fit their white supremacist philosophy. And it's just like, what is this? Yeah.
So do you think it's a culture? It's not baked in. It's cultural. It's what we're taught. It's a reflection of what the political conversation
Yeah. I do. I feel like, look, I think it gets really, really, really complicated. And I don't like to say some of the things that I say because I know that they are purposefully, I say them purposefully to make people a little uncomfortable, but I don't get any joy out of saying them. But for example, what if our history was being told from a different perspective? Let's just say our history was being told from the perspective of the first peoples, the indigenous peoples on these lands. What if they were writing the history books from beginning to end, which raises the question of why aren't they, which then makes you think about, well, what happened to them? What happened to all of their intellectuals? But okay, if they were telling the history, would they would probably say, and I'm going to use this term, which is a term I do not like and I do not use, but the history books would say the first illegal aliens who arrived on this land were the pilgrims. I don't use the term illegal alien. I don't use the term illegal to describe a human being, and I certainly don't use the term alien to describe a human being. But I'm doing that purposefully so that people can just be like, ooh. You know, nobody wants... I'm having a real problem with some of the terms that we have been using for so long. So again, I don't say this with joy. But what is slavery if not corporatized, government-supported international human trafficking? That's hard when you sit with that and then you think like, wait, so our founding fathers were okay with human trafficking. What does that mean about us? It means that we really have a lot of complicated conversations. But the other side of that story is that I mean, we're having these conversations in the United States of America now. We are talking about this. And frankly, what Martin Luther King Jr. says, you know, the arc of the moral universe is long. It's hella long in this country. It's hella long. You know, we're kind of like, all right, it's slow motion moving forward. But now we're at a point where we're not moving forward. We're moving backwards. And this is very confusing. This is very confusing.
It's interesting you say that because one of the things that Jelani Cobb said in another one of these conversations was that we have to...
He has a much better voice than mine, I have to say. I'm just saying.
I don't know. You're just a pretty good voice. He said we have to be willing to confront our past, our racist past. And he says the problem is we need to be clear of what we're capable of and what we've done. And he said the problem is we've defined ourselves as this exceptional country. So we have a hard time owning that. Do you see that too?
Oh my God, I see that. I mean, what I see is... what I see is our desire to be continually exceptional means we want to be normal, means we want to normalize everything that's going on, and things are not normal. I don't care what anybody says. This is not a normal time in our country. It is normal in the sense that, okay, racial tensions, divisions, class divisions, you know, gender is like, you know, exploding. And in that sense, okay, that's, you know, humanity, I guess, writ large. But it is not normal in the sense of what we are being presented with. So...
wait, Maria, say a little bit more about that, because I've heard you say that immigrants didn't used to be the focus of this ire, that you're seeing something new. It's fully frontal, you said. There was this sense of attack. Is it different? You're seeing something
different.
Oh, yeah.
For example, my students, mostly Latinx, are talking about the fact that they, you know, these are kids who live in the suburbs. My A student, who is brown, formerly undocumented, now I think has a green card or citizenship, and suddenly he sees an unmarked SUV behind him. And unfortunately, because he's a college student with an adolescent brain, he's like, well, let me see if it really is a car that's following me. So he does a rolling stop. Not smart. But he gets pulled over immediately, and a plainclothes immigration agent comes to the window. What is this? Plainclothes immigration agents. So what's difficult for many Latinos and Latinas is that not all of us are living in that kind of fear. I'm not living in that kind of fear. I have other kinds of fear, but I'm not living in that kind of fear. But I will tell you, I was just in Queens, New York City. And apparently what ICE is doing is that it is sending plainclothes agents who look like, you know, regular people coming to knock on people's doors at 6 o'clock in the morning. And because people now in these communities have become so afraid that they know that when they hear that bang on the door, they are not opening that door. All hell could be breaking loose, but they are not opening that door because they have come to understand that at least they have that right not to open the door. What we don't realize, because we're talking about the impact that this is having on immigrants and what they're feeling, and as we say, lo viven en carne propia, like we're feeling it in our own skin, in our own meat, we're feeling this. But what everybody needs to realize is that the challenges of people being denied due process on a daily, it's like happening to immigrants right now, but who's it going to happen to next? So what does it look like when I'm talking about lack of due process? So for example, they will come to your house. You know, it is unlawful to impersonate a law enforcement officer. ICE is not police. They are ICE immigration agents. Their outfits say police everywhere. So when you look through the keyhole, you're going to see police, and you know you have to open the door to the police. But you don't have to open the door to immigration agents. So that's one violation, just misrepresenting. You know how we all watch SVU, our favorite TV show ever in history? And, you know, everybody now knows about the Miranda Act and how you have to be Mirandized when you're arrested. You know, you are being told why, how, etc. When you're an immigrant who's taken none of that, you don't get a Miranda. What, you think you deserve to be told? where you're being taken, for what reason, you're just an illegal. Don't ask any questions. This thing about having a lawyer, no lawyer provided. This thing about having a phone call, maybe, not by law. This thing about having legally binding requirements for how you are held, hello, we are watching children warehoused right now in front of our faces. We see it on the morning television. Those are not conditions under which anybody should be held, but those children, those people have no legal right to demand that they be held in better conditions. So that kind of violation of due process, you know, how does it feel? How would you feel if your son or daughter is in a courtroom getting an order of protection from their boyfriend who is beating them? And your son or daughter is about to get that order of protection, but instead, an immigration agent, a plainclothes immigration agent, is sitting in the back of that courtroom and takes your son or daughter and then puts them into an unmarked car. How do you, as American citizens, feel about plainclothes agents taking individuals and putting them into unmarked cars? I'm sorry, and this is going to be very shocking to some of you, and I'm sorry. But you know what? The Gestapo identified themselves. The Gestapo wore uniforms. People are being taken right now by people who we don't even know who they are. And there's no sense of having to explain because we have become illegal. We're an illegal people. We're illegal human beings. We're the illegals. Therefore, who cares how we're held? Who cares?
You've said something once about you don't like the term illegal immigrant. Makes no sense grammatically. It makes no sense for a number of reasons. You've also said you're not crazy about the term separated families.
Not crazy at all, of it at all. Because that is not what's happening. A separation of family sounds as scientific and innocuous as the Japanese internment. There was no Japanese internment. I don't even know what that means. These were not Japanese people. And what is an internment? The Japanese internment is actually the imprisonment of American citizens who happen to be of Japanese descent. So the way we speak about things. So separation, I'm going to, again, be provoking in a way that I wish I didn't have to be. But is the correct terminology is what's happening is actually the government is holding these children hostage? Is this government profiting off of the warehousing of children? Is this government holding children for ransom? Is this government kidnapping children? Is this government trafficking children across state lines? Are these children that are being imprisoned by a foreign government, innocent children who have committed no crime? If 10 American citizen children were picked up by Argentine police and taken away from their parents because their parents were dealing drugs in Argentina and Buenos Aires, and the Argentinian government took away those children and were holding them, quote unquote, for the children's own good, there would be hell to pay. That's the same thing that's happening now at a tune of what is the latest number, 11,000, 12,000, 13,000 children?
Maria Hinojosa. She's host and executive producer of the NPR show Latino USA, which you can now hear starting tonight, Mondays at 9, here on KUER. We spoke with her last week. It was the final installment of our Realities of Diversity speaker series, our partnership with the United Way of Salt Lake. She joined us in the moot courtroom at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with Maria Hinojosa. Maria is a Mexican-American, an immigrant, a Latina journalist who came to her work as a way of telling stories about people like her, stories she says she didn't hear growing up. She joined us last week in the moot courtroom at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. This was the final installment in our Realities of Diversity speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. One of the questions you ask on the program, Latina USA, amongst yourselves, you're talking about this, is this. We're living in this time of demographic change, lots of change. Who decides what objectivity is? You said this is a conversation you're having. What do you mean?
So I actually worked for Walter Cronkite. Some of you know who he is. You know, I mean, I watched Walter Cronkite. You know, he was one of my heroes. First of all, I never, ever, ever, when I was watching Cronkite, ever thought I would be a journalist. Ever. Much less ever working with him. But many, many, many years later, 1987, I'm working for Walter Cronkite. And I was his radio producer at CBS Radio Network, and I had to write his end-of-the-year commentary. I had to write his end-of-the-year commentary for the year 1987. That was the year of Oliver North. And I wrote a commentary that was really strong. But I remember it was pointed. Central America was happening, refugees, you know. My editor looked at it, and he said, Walter Cronkite cannot read this. He is not in the mind of a 26-year-old Latina, you know. And I said, and I thought to myself, first of all, I'm a great journalist and writer, so I did my task. So you're already taking away my power and my agency. But second of all, at that moment I was like, I love Walter Cronkite and I love what he's done, but I don't see the world through his eyes. As much as I can try, I'm not going to be able to see the world through his eyes. But guess what? His eyes are not the only eyes that are valuable as they are looking at the American story. And so I insisted that we take that commentary, and we went down to what's called the Fishbowl at CBS Evening News, and we found one of the senior editors at the Evening News who knew. I said, you're not allowed to tell him who wrote it, what it was. You're just going to give him the piece of paper, cold. And I was there. And he took it down. He just said, hey, I want you to just take a look at this commentary for Cronkite. What do you think? And he read it. That's good. Really good. And that was when my editor had to look at me and kind of be like, how much judgment was he carrying with him as to my inability to be a good journalist? So I just want us to be clear, like again, you know, this whole conversation about how women have been treated in the workplace and what we've been, you know, in terms of the world of journalism, most of the narrative is being told through the perspective of white men. They are the majority of the people who run America's newsrooms, whether we like it or not. It's the truth. Our newsrooms have become less diverse since 9/11, not more diverse since 9/11. And so when we were uncovering these things that were happening with women being sexually harassed, even within our own business, it was like, wow, you see? Well, why weren't we telling this story? You guys were totally convinced that you were completely objective about everything, so objective that you weren't seeing what was happening right in front of you. So what we need is we need journalists to be hyper-aware at all times.
This is a question I asked Jelani Cobb also. Is Donald Trump a racist?
Yes. It brings me no joy to say that. No. But you know, I've been in New York City since 1979. New Yorkers know a con when we see a con. I'm sorry to say that about the President of the United States. But also, we will never forget the fact that he said, basically, burn these five young men alive, the Central Park Five, even after they were exonerated. Sadly, he has shown his true colors.
One of the things that Jelani mentioned, and I want to get you on this as well, he was noticing during the 2016 race that a lot of the Republican candidates for president were struggling to find the right language to express white ethnic resentment. But Trump managed to speak it fluently, is how he put it. And that was, he thought, part of his appeal, as he just came right out and said it. You know, shithole countries and Mexican rapists and NFL players, sons of bitches, and Haitians all having AIDS. I mean, there's a litany of this. And you've yourself talked about the rhetoric you're hearing from this administration. It seems like words and language is important to you. Would you say something about what you're hearing?
I think what saddens me the most is not the, you know, whether it's attacking women or calling them, you know, horrible names like horse faces, or whether it's attacking Mexicans and saying we're all MS-13. I think what hurts me the most is the assault on American democracy. I think that's the thing that I'm most in pain about. Oh, you see, I get all verklempt. Because actually, so here's the thing. See, I had to raise this hand and take an oath. So I don't know about all of y'all, but I actually had to go in and raise my hand and really think about, you know, saying I will take up arms to defend this country. So therefore, I take this thing really seriously, like this whole civic duty and our commitment to, you know, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And I take this stuff really, really seriously. So watching the assault on democracy, watching the assault on all of our institutions, many of which, by the way, as a journalist, I'm highly critical of. But there is a way in which we can be productive in the conversation, and there's a way in which we can be destructive. And sadly, I'm not sure what this president's intentions are. But, you know, it just breaks my heart when I... And by the way, I think that the people who are kind of with the president, like in the sense of being really... racist and closed-minded, is a minority of the minority that they represent. I think I understand, I work really hard at understanding people's sense of being othered. So I'm not surprised that what ended up being proven by the data was not that white America was feeling economically challenged, but rather that white America was feeling like their place was being challenged. And, you know, when I think about those protesters in Charlottesville chanting, "You will not replace us," I'm like, oh my God, you guys are so stupid. We have no intention of replacing you, you dummies. We want to hang out with you. We want to become your friends. We want to party with you. We want to fall in love with you. We want to work with you. We want to work for you. We want to work. We want you to work for us. But we want to hang out with you. I mean, I've never, ever heard of any immigrant ever, and I've been doing this my whole life talking to immigrants, ever saying, "Uy, no, pues no, yo voy para reemplazarlos a todos." "Uy, no, pues que se hagan de lado. Uy, no, 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 pues que se hagan de lado, que ahí voy yo a sacarlos a todos." Ay, please. So in case you didn't understand that, none of them ever said, "Hey, I'm coming to replace you," with a Mexican accent, you know? "I'm coming to replace you." No, we don't know, never. That's not the way we think. You know what? Mexicans have been living with Americans our whole lives. You come to our country and you party in our countries and you buy land in our country when you don't have permission, and you you get drunk and act really inappropriately, and you treat our women badly, and you do not nice things. And still, we're like, well, we still want to go up north and see what that's like.
One of the things you've said is, why do we fear who we already are?
The issue around not being being afraid is that, first of all, We have always been a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-layered country. From the time that our first peoples lived here, where there were multiple nations living here, we were already that diverse. You bring to that, by the way, the first people who came here were not the pilgrims. It was in St. Augustine in Florida. But already the mixing, the first language that was spoken actually was by the first ones who arrived was Spanish in Florida. And then the second settlement was actually in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Then the pilgrims arrived. So already we were a diverse, quote-unquote, country. And we have been that. You know, I mean, it's not nice to know. Recently I spent some time in Oregon, and I didn't realize that part of what Oregon did in its own history was to declare it a white state and gave a deadline for all black people to leave. So, we have been this multiracial country for the longest. And, so why are we afraid? Why are we afraid? And that's what makes me so sad about what's happened in our country, because when I say that I've traveled to all 50 states and two territories, Guam and Puerto Rico, and most people are very open to talking. Still, when I'm talking to them and I'm getting to know them, and they're Trump supporters or they're Trump voters who are maybe rethinking, but I'm having very direct conversations. They are me. I see myself in them, and I let them know that. I am you, and you are me, and there's nothing to be afraid of. There's really nothing to be afraid of. Can we talk to each other?
One of the things you've said, and this, I think this will get us to this conversation of how we approach this dialogue, is you said that, you know, there's this older generation feeling displaced, right? But you say we have to offer them compassion and understanding.
Absolutely.
Talk about that.
So I actually developed, I experienced tremendous fear, even though I had been a war correspondent. It wasn't until I lived through 9/11. At the time, I was a correspondent for CNN, and I covered that story every day for a year that I developed PTSD. But I remember the fear, the shock of the fear of what I witnessed with actually seeing one of the first tower coming down, and the trauma and the shock, and just like that visceral fear. So that allowed me to understand people's fear of something that feels scary and unexplained and changing. You know, Muslims in their neighborhood, or gay people, or gay people getting married, or a trans person, or a Mexican undocumented person. And so Guy Garcia, a fellow journalist and writer, said that, you know, in some ways, some sectors of white America feel like they're the new immigrants. They look around their America and they're like, I don't understand this country where they're speaking Spanish and where there are a lot of brown folks and where white people are marrying black people and where men are marrying men and, you know, trans people. What is this? This feel, what is this place? I want to understand their compassion, that it does feel strange and it can feel like it's out of control. But that's why I spend some time talking about, well, let's look at, you know, the fear that people felt when women wanted to vote, or the fear that people felt when black people wanted to be free. And now we're not afraid of that. And how we as a country have been figuring it out, and we will figure it out, and that there's this thing called democracy, and it's about participation and engagement and conversation and this. And I truly believe that the conversations that I have with people at that level, they're right there with me. They're like, okay, I'm less afraid. And I'm like, yeah, me too.
It seems like part of the answer is what you're saying is that if we can make this personal. And I wanted to ask you about some of the stories you've been doing lately. There's a woman named Ana Maria Archila. She was the woman in the elevator, or one of the women in the elevator, who confronted Senator Flake. She's an immigrant from Colombia. And you've said that until you interviewed her, no one had really asked her about her perspective. This seems like a really good example of personalizing a story. Would you talk about this story?
So what happened was, you know, we all, that day, actually, I was super busy at work and actually a little bit in denial. I wasn't even watching the news because I was, sometimes I go into denial even though I'm a journalist. I wasn't going to be filing that day. And I ended up then getting home that evening and looked through my Twitter feed and I saw this thing. And I was like, oh my God, who are these women? And then I tried immediately. I was like finding on Twitter. I was like, who are they? Who are they? Who are they? Who are they? I mean, she's obviously a Latina immigrant with an accent. Who is she? And then I was like, oh my God, she's Ana Maria Archila. I know her. I know of her. I think maybe I had met her once before. And so immediately I got in touch. And this is the good part about getting older is that people like know about you, and they're like, oh, I've been listening to you for years. And I'm like, okay. And so she was like, I'm thrilled to hear from you. And I said, I want to interview you right away for In the Thick and for Latino USA. It was Sunday. That happened on a Friday. We were interviewing her on Sunday. It was Sunday at noon, and I asked her, I said, were you not just on all of the Sunday morning talk shows? Meet the Press, This Week, Face the Nation. I'm sorry, were you not just on those talk shows? And she was like, nope, they didn't call. I was a little like, okay. So we sat down and we did an interview, and that was where we talked about her kind of immigrant experience and how she became an activist because of her immigrant experience, and that it was through her work around immigration in New York City that she became an activist and then learned a particular tactic of activism, which is called bird dogging, which is what they did in the elevator. Bird dogging is a tactic where people are trained how to engage with their elected officials. And they are told how to just come to them, find them wherever they might be, and say, I want to speak to you and I want you to hear my personal story. This is a personal issue. And that's where the look at me comes from. Yeah. If the politician looks away, that's when you say, no, look at me when I'm speaking to you. I didn't realize that that was something that they were trained to do. So Maria Archila, Ana Maria Archila gets to that point of getting in that elevator because of the fact that she's an immigrant activist. And no one had asked her about that. Like, no one had asked her, so are you an immigrant by any chance? So, hey, what... No one. And exactly, that was the part of the story that we were able to get to. And she was so thankful. And no matter what happened, she is part of American history. She is part of American history. And I just want to say that there are many Latinas, in particular, women Latinas, who have recently had an impact. Whatever you think of their politics, Emma Gonzalez from Parkland, who helped to organize the March for Our Lives. Edna Chavez, the young woman Edna Chavez from L.A. who spoke at that huge march. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in Queens, who won over a Democratic, somebody who had been there for a very long time, was very much expected to win, and Ana Maria Archila. And so I have been saying for the longest time, just because I don't know why, but I believe Latinas are really going to be having a major impact in the political narrative, and it's coming true. So thank you. Because I feel like, in Spanish, there's a saying, que se nos ha colmado el plato. How do you say that in English? Like fed up, but in Spanish, in Mexican Spanish, se me ha colmado el plato. You know, it's like, and so I think that part of what's happened is that rage has led us to just kind of own our voices in a way that's kind of fascinating to watch, but I think it's going to be really wonderful for our country, not because Latinas are anything special. We're just American women who are owning our voice in this moment.
I wanted to mention another woman that you've been talking to not so long ago, Estrella Gonzalez, an undocumented transgender woman. She filed this protective order in a courthouse in El Paso. immigration enforcement agents were in there, and they arrested her. And you and Jonathan Hirsch, one of the reporters that works for you, spent like a year interviewing her in prison where she is now in West Texas. Talk about Estrella.
So Estrella is probably the most unsympathetic character in America right now. She is Mexican. She's a trans woman. She's queer. She's formally deported. She has a criminal record of fraud, nothing violent. She was trafficked, and they forced her to commit that fraud. So she has a lot of things going against her. And you know what, Estrella, it's a very long and complicated story, which we tried to tell. You know, it all really starts from the fact that she was born a very effeminate boy in Acapulco, Mexico. And she grew up in a time when there was a rash of anti-gay hatred and murders in Acapulco specifically. And this is what violent homophobia looks like. She had to leave her country and then ends up here, and it gets really complicated. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time with Estrella. She has given us an exclusive. She's in prison right now in central Texas, near Midland, actually. You know, and when I talked to Estrella, and I went to visit her over the summer. She is now getting her hormones. When she was first put into prison in West Texas, it was the first time that they were dealing with a trans person, so they didn't know anything about hormones or hormone shots, and she was harassed, and then they moved her to another prison. She's now getting her hormone shot. She's very happy that she's as she talks about her boobies. Mis boobies están muy lindas, mis boobies. I know, she's adorable. I mean, talking about like this in the prison. Estrella pled guilty. She will probably serve a total of 8 years in prison for a nonviolent crime that she, again, under threat from the traffickers, she had to commit these basically check fraud. But what's really strange and crazy and weird and almost unbelievable is that Estrella, were it not for the fact that she was detained by ICE agents, this was there where she came out as a trans woman. So prior to that, she was what she calls a gay boy. And when she was arrested the very first time many years ago, she was raped in prison as a gay boy. And so when she was taken by ICE, this is when she was able to say, I am a trans woman and you have to respect me as a trans woman and I have to be protected as a trans woman. But that moment was what forced her to kind of own that, which is really crazy and strange, but it is part of what the United States of America is right now. But I have to say, when I talk to Estrella, just I want you to know that she's okay. She's okay. She's dealing with difficult things. The last call she told me was that her cellmate tried to assault her, multiple times, and then they moved her to another section of the prison where it was all the ultra-religious people, and then she said she had to be moved from there because they just kept telling her that she was going to go to hell because she was trans. And so it was like, where can she finally find some peace? And apparently now she's okay.
You talked about this need for a dialogue, that we need to have a conversation. How does that work? What does it look like? What are these dialogues? Are they just the stories that you're creating, or is there another? Is there a setting where we get together, or should we do these in community? Should we do them in public? I mean, what does it look like?
All of the above.
Yeah,
all of it. Every single part of it. All of it. And for me, I'm doing it all of the time as much as I can. So yeah, I love putting our journalism out there, and the fact that now we're going to be carried here in Salt Lake City at KUER. We're so thrilled. So, the journalism, I think, helps. But we're in front of a live audience. There's over 100 people here, if not more. We're looking at each other's faces. We're making eye contact as we're having these conversations. I'm having these conversations in cars and planes all the time. All the time. And I never know how it's going to turn out, you know, but I'm having that conversation and I look at people in the eye and I'm just like, I'm right here. I am that Mexican person. I am that person who's afraid, actually. I have family members who have green cards. I'm afraid for them. And then sometimes I'll say, look, you know, I'm a person who became a citizen in the late 1980s. Right now, USCIS, United States Citizenship and Information Services, one of their main jobs right now is to track down people who became citizens and take away their citizenship. So I say to people, look at me, because I am that person that could potentially be seen as a threat. Do you see me? I'm right here. Which is why I want to be on Tucker Carlson's show, because I know Tucker Carlson. I've known him for, you know, since 1997 is when I met him. And I want to look him in the eye and ask him, point blank, Tucker, if he is really afraid, does he really think his children should be afraid of my children because my children speak Spanish and are tied to their Latino immigrant roots? Like, are you really going to tell your kids, Tucker, to beware of my kids? So he hasn't said yes.
Do you think he believes that? Or do you think it's talk?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. I guess that's the other question I want to ask. If it is just all an act, why are we doing this? I know why I'm doing this. I know why I do the work that I do. I talked about civic duty. I talked about, you know, my commitment to the First Amendment and my admiration for the freedom of the press in this country, and I'm going to fight for that. I know why I do what I do. Why does he do what he does? I want to know.
Was there ever a time when you just wanted to leave? You know, take your kids, go to Mexico or the Dominican Republic where your husband is from. Just like, I'm not doing this anymore.
I thought that just a little couple hours ago, I'm thinking. Well, because a bigger question for me is what does this country mean? Why did we come here? Why did we come here we witnessed the murder of Khashoggi, a journalist with a green card. And this president is seemingly allowing this to happen, an act committed by a foreign government. And so I do question. I'm like, why did we come here? Should my children, you know, they're 20 and 22, so they can make their own decisions. Sure, I feel that way. I'm like, wow, I really could go just live on the beach for a while.
I thought about that because reading your book, where you were thinking, I want to have my kids in Mexico and yeah, and come back. And then I thought maybe she wants to just ditch every once in a while.
I do ditch every once in a while,
yeah.
Already. I do. I'm leaving on Sunday night to Mexico City. I was in the Dominican Republic in August. I'll be back in Mexico in January. But the thing is that I'm not leaving. I am not leaving. I am not going anywhere. And I tell people that, you know, again, as Martin Luther King said, this is long. This is a long, long battle. And we are part of this conversation. I don't want to see it as a battle. I'm sorry I said that word. But when people say, I'm going to give up, I'm like, I don't even know what that means. I just don't know. And I do have that illusion of like, you know, well, we could go live on a farm, you know, in Italy where our son is moving, as a matter of fact, in January. He has a job in Italy, so off he goes. You know, we could just have a farm and make food and have little baby goats and, you know, but fascism could also be on the rise in Italy. And I don't feel like we can just kind of escape this. And I feel like that's irresponsible. So The truth is that everybody in this room, most likely, and maybe listening to this, are people with extraordinary privilege. And we're probably going to make it out of this okay. But there are so many people who have no way to protect themselves. And stuff is coming at them in a way that is not just and frankly legally binding. Just look at Stop and Frisk in New York City. And so it cannot be that we're like just with our privilege of like, poof, okay, well, we'll survive this. And we'll see you on the other side. That's just not the way I see this country going. So I think about it a lot. I can leave a lot, but we have this thing on Latino USA, we say, no te vayas. So it means don't go anywhere. So no me voy. I'm not going anywhere.
Maria Hinojosa. She's founder of the Futuro Media Group, host and executive producer of the NPR show Latino USA, which you can now hear Monday nights at 9 here on KUER. She also co-hosts the podcast called In the Thick. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Brian Albers and Troy Haas. Our thanks to Bill Krim, to Geraldine Stowe, Ashley Razan, and the whole United Way team. Thanks also to Chris Monty, Sam Mills, and the S.J. Quinney College of Law. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.